the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Grammy-nominated songwriter and record producer Phil Galdston is my guest. He's written dozens of hits, including Vanessa Williams' classic Save the Best for Last, hits for the chest-pounding Celine Dion, for Cher, and many others in a variety of musical genres. Phil Galdston has also written and produced material for comedians Robin Williams and Robert Klein. Phil Galdston, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks so much, Gary.
You know, in pop music post Bob Dylan and the Beatles, we mostly think of artists writing their own material, but are there a lot of professional songwriters out there?
Well, there are fewer and fewer every day due to a variety of factors, but certainly there was a tremendous increase in the number of people who wrote their own material. And that started post-Dylan, post-Beatles, or concomitant with both. But at the same time, there was a tremendous flourishing market and activity by so-called professional writers. I mean, it's so funny that we're called professional writers. What are the others? They're professionals, too.
But, well, I mean, I guess there are people who write songs and then send them off, you know.
Yeah. Well, generally we're called pure songwriters, mm-hmm. and I don't know what's pure about us, but I think what that really means is we're not somehow contaminated by the notion we can perform our own work.
Well, did you were you at one time thinking of your life as a performer, and you just became so you started as a singer-songwriter, so to speak?
Yes, I know very few people, very few colleagues who ever started out just as songwriters, just with that idea. Generally speaking, I find, particularly in my work as a member of the faculty at NYU, that most people who are foolish enough to have the idea they can do this for a living start out with the idea that they're going to be a superstar, or certainly what their writing is going to be best expressed through their own performances.
Well, because I guess most songwriters, or at least we were led to believe this, kind of write from themselves, kind of about themselves, expressing themselves. So how do you do that if you're writing for Celine Dion, say?
Well, I think that you use an interesting term there. We are led to believe. The fact is that writing songs is really no more, it's no more a given that writing songs is confessional or purely from a personal perspective than writing novels is, or writing anything else, or writing movies is. The fact that you can do it in kind of a low-key, small configuration may promote that idea. But certainly there are plenty of people who write songs, and plenty of successful people who write songs, and have been, who write with the idea that they're going to create something that a specific artist will be inclined to sing. And certainly from time to time, those of us who have enjoyed some success with it are usually invited by a particular artist to write a song for them.
So the artist contact you. You don't have, like, it's not like song pluggers in the Tin Pan.
Oh, no, it is. It is.
Oh, yeah.
You know, both exist. I mean, I'm frequently asked, how do you get a song to a major artist? Or how do you get a major artist to record a song? And I have a very simple answer. By any means necessary. You just do what you can. It's a relentless game, and at times truly a game, of promoting the work, and sometimes promoting yourself to be in a position to take advantage of an opportunity to have your work heard. But go back to the question of how you write. You know, how did I write for Celine Dion? Well, generally speaking, I write, I call it informed writing. I'm aware of what's going on in pop music and other genres in which I write, and I'm aware to a degree of who's looking for what. Sometimes I'm extremely aware, sometimes I'm called and asked. So with that kind of general background to the consciousness of the market, if you will, and I don't just mean that commercially, I mean the artistic market as well, my writing is informed. On the other hand, by and large, I've been most successful when I've just written whatever is coming out that day or those days. And then when it's coming out, if it has a particular sensibility to me that, that seems appropriate for an artist. Well, I know I'm headed in that direction, and that might be my first stop. But a lot of times, I only have kind of a vague idea of that. That will become more clear to me when I start to make the demonstration recording, the demo. And then I really have to think about how I'm going to present it and to whom that might appeal.
So when you're first writing a song, it comes to you as Phil Galston, but then after a while you think, oh, Cher, I could do this for Cher.
Yeah, although I'd shade that this way. Sure, it's coming out of Phil Galston or from whatever source I'm getting it. I'm not one of those who looks up to the sky and says, thank you for sending this through me, but I certainly have had my experiences of it, of feeling that there's some other influence over this work. But that said, one of the great joys of writing songs is really not terribly different from that which creative people speak of when they create, particularly novelists, poets, etc., and that is that you can take on the role of any character you want. I mean, I frequently will note that I've been happily married for 30 years, and in that time, I didn't really have a lot of motivation to write a heartsick, lovesick song. I didn't have a lot of romantic tragedy in that period. In fact, I had none. So how could I write that? Well, I could write that by doing exactly what other authors do, and that's imagine a scenario or be struck by a scenario that I read about or heard about that motivated me.
So there's a certain acting element in it.
There's a tremendous... I mean, you can call it acting because I think you're still thinking of it, and there's nothing the matter with this, you're still thinking of it as writing songs as being a kind of a performance. And there is a truth to that. But I'd say before that happens, there is just the, what's the backstory? I think the literary analog to songwriting is short stories. That's how I see it. What you leave out is at least as important as what you put in, sometimes more so. So if you, when Wendy Waldman and I wrote the lyrics to Save the Best for Last, I wrote the music with John Lind, and when I wrote the lyric with Wendy, who's one of my favorite collaborators on the lyric side, we spent a lot of time actually bashing out a story, going back and forth. What is the story? What's going on here? And then when we were done with the lyric, or as we wrote the lyric, we gradually were, of course, removing things. So, certainly there are limitations of time in songwriting and limitations of space in a way because, you know, you've got to deal not only with the length of it, but the pace of it and the structure of it.
So you know more about that song than we do because there's this backstory that informs.
Yeah, yeah, I know a lot about it. and that's true. I say that that's true of a lot of the songs I've written in my life, and it is particularly true after writing that song. Well before the time it was successful, it just was a great breakthrough moment in chewing the fat and having fun with that. And then it leads to all the inevitable questions. Well, would this narrator say this? You know, would this character do that? Gee, I don't know. And how am I conveying that to the audience? And then, of course, the more you get into that, the more each word and musical nuance, this is not just about lyrics, become really, really important.
Well, when you're writing a song, is the arrangement part of the composition? I mean, do you hear the arrangement, or is that something that you layer on afterwards?
It can be either way, but because I'm a producer as well, because I'm a musician as well, I'm very often putting it all together. But if you ask me, and you're welcome to, if you ask me what kind of songwriting, quote-unquote, I like the most...
Phil, what kind of songwriting do you like the most?
Thanks, Gary. Thanks for asking, Gary. I like writing it from the ground up. I like walking into the room and saying to a collaborator, and I like to collaborate. I've written very few songs on my own since I started collaborating just a couple of years into songwriting. And I like coming in the room and fooling around. Somebody's got a musical motif, or you're talking about a subject that intrigues you, or you're talking about some genre that's cool right now, or maybe there's a performer or another writer who's stimulating. And I particularly love, either from the beginning or perhaps before any other inspiration appears, starting with a title or a concept. I keep a little collection of ideas like that. It started as handwritten notes in a little book in college, and has grown to 2,500 ideas in a PDA. So I'm always thinking about that. I'm always listening. I'm always looking. I'm chatting with somebody, and they say something cool, and I whip out my book and write it down, and, or ask if it's okay if I write it down. And very often, at my level of experience, I'm asked to serve as kind of a song editor or song doctor. I've done a lot of work where I've just written lyrics, and that's fun, too. I mean, it's all fun. And one of the great things about being a songwriter, as opposed to being a performer or a performer-songwriter, is that you really don't have to fit in the same boxes everybody else has to fit in.
Just joining us, we're talking to Phil Goldston, songwriter. Let's talk about Vanessa Williams for a minute. I mean, with Vanessa, you had great success with her album that had Save the Best for Last on it, and then her next album, which I think you were also affiliated with,
mm-hmm.
and that album did, it did well, but not as well,
mm-hmm.
and then, you know, subsequent albums did less well until finally the public lost interest in her as a singer.
Yeah. I'm not sure that the public is totally lost interest. I mean, the last album was the number one jazz album, and I had a song on that. But
You know, I'm sure the jazz album was good, but probably didn't sell that kind of major numbers.
No, it didn't. And I don't think going in that anybody involved had those expectations, because as soon as you say the word jazz in the United States, you're cutting your sales by 90% probably,
right,
versus pop, or the potential of your sales. But I think that the business side of it, forget the creative side, the way the business side works now, and has worked for more than 10 years, maybe 15 years, is that the record companies, by and large, no matter what they say, they're not building models to last. They're not building the beast that's going to grow and change and develop.
I guess they never were. I mean, the things that lasted in spite of record companies, right?
I think we can say that Parlophone and Capitol in the United States got the hell out of the way of the Beatles and let them do what they do. They were not going to stop them. I mean, you can see many, many, many examples of that when you really study them. Everything from the fact that they were initially given, they made their first album in 10 hours,
mm-hmm.
and they made Sgt. Pepper in 4 to 5 months.
6 months, yeah.
Yeah, and so by then, nobody was giving him a hard time. Nobody was asking any questions. And if they wanted new gear, they got new gear. And those were the days where the Beatles' recording time was not even counted against their royalties. Whether record companies, and I don't mean to paint record companies or the people in them. Let's remember, there are people running those companies.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean to paint them all as evil. I don't see it that way.
Well, they're out to be successful.
They're out to be successful. So the question is, you know, there's a joke among music makers, and the joke is kind of a not such a happy joke, but the joke is, you know, Bob Dylan wouldn't get signed today.
Right.
Right?
Just can't sing.
Randy Newman would not be given 4 or 5 albums to prove that he could build an audience. That just wouldn't happen now.
Right.
And there are a lot of reasons why.
I guess that's true in all media. I mean, people
don't
get a season to let their show get off the ground.
Except that until recently, one of the cool things about cable was, because the expectations were relatively low, you might get a little more time to develop that. You might.
Mm-hmm.
Theoretically, on the web, that's what you're getting. But
right.
But you're right. I think that's a totally relevant comparison. The point I'm getting at is that the net effect of this is a certain stultifying atmosphere for not only the artist, not only the artist who wants to interpret, but for the songwriter. I remember a few years ago, I wrote a song that's one of my favorites. I wrote it with a good friend and close collaborator, Brock Walsh, who's enjoyed a lot of success. And the song, when we first wrote it, was called When I Was Rich. And it's kind of a country-flavored, Nashville-flavored song. And the idea of it might be obvious, I don't know, is that when I was rich, I had you. Now I have all the material things in life, and I don't have you, and I'm not rich. I'm no longer rich. And so I was up at a record company, waiting in the lobby to have a meeting with an A&R person. A person who controls artists and repertoire. And I was standing in the lobby, and a lot of record company offices now feature in their lobbies multiple video screens playing the videos that their artists have recently released. And I was standing there, and I was thinking, if the president of the label walked in right now and said, hey, you have a minute, come to my office and play me your favorite song, without regard to its appropriateness for a particular artist, what would I play? Which song would I play? And I thought to myself, oh, I'd play When I Was Rich. And then I stood there for a little while longer, and I began to watch the video screens a little more carefully. I couldn't hear them. I could just watch them.
Yeah.
And I noticed that in every one of them, there wasn't a single one in which the star performer was not either a hero or perhaps someone who might be the subject of some romantic inequity of some kind. But none of them, not a single one, was someone who was truly down on their luck, suffering through some great sadness from which there was no escape. None of that. It just, you know, choose your poison. It wasn't on the screen. And so suddenly the light bulb went off, and I thought, oh, wait a minute. The problem with When I Was Rich is I. And I resolved at that moment, and I called Brock, and he agreed to change it to When He Was Rich.
Hmm. Okay.
But the point is, that to me is an excellent illustration from the inside of the songwriting world. One of those factors, one of those aspects of songs that is profoundly influenced by the factors we've been discussing.
So a commercial influence altered the artistic bent of the song to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, made me think a lot about, that's why I call it informed writing, made me think a lot about, well, you know, I'm a loser. Okay, the Beatles, Lennon wrote I'm a Loser, Beck had a song called Loser.
Right.
But, you know, would you hear that now? You might. I mean, it's a pretty broad world out there, but if we're talking the big commercial broad strokes,
likely. Well, we're talking with Phil Galdston, the songwriter. Vanessa Williams was perfectly poised at that moment, what was it, 92 that year?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
To have a hit record. That is, you know, she was Miss America, then she had to resign, or she had her title taken away because of the nude photographs that were published of her, and so there was a salacious scandal about her,
mm-hmm.
and then she triumphed and over this adversity, And so it was the perfect moment for her to come out with a record that was really great. You know, Wendy Waldman, she's a fine singer and songwriter and has, you know, maybe half a dozen albums on Warner Brothers in the 70s. Although, and she had hits recorded by Maria Muldaur and others, and Bette Midler too, right? But mm-hmm. never really got, you know, she never had that big hit for herself. Mm-hmm. And did she think, man, you know, this could have been my hit?
Oh, no, not on that song. That wasn't, I mean, Wendy has recorded the song subsequently, but no, at that time she didn't. But you've just pinpointed, leave Wendy out of it for a second, you've just pinpointed what I'm trying to hit on. And that is the idea that Vanessa had a story. You can perceive the arc now of what the story was, and there were those, and you probably would have been one at the time who could perceive it then. Here's somebody who's looking for redemption, and one of the redemptions she's going to have, if it works, is through quality. She'd had a hit single before that, a song called Dreamin', which is a good pop song. And then what happened was Ed Eckstein, the president of the label, the son of Billy Eckstein, found this song, was played this song by Wendy's publisher, and grabbed it. And there's a lovely story associated with that, and that is that when Ed played the song for Vanessa, she burst into tears at its end and said, "You mean they're willing to let me sing this?"
Oh, gosh.
And, you know, we find that very touching because obviously it's the beginning of something that worked out well for all of us. But the point that you and I think, are connecting here is if Whitney Houston or Bette Midler or Barbara Streisand had released that song, I'm not sure it would have gotten to the same place because it wouldn't have the same story attached to it. And, you know, we can say the same thing about Taylor Swift to a degree. We can say, well, if a 30-year-old were... If Carrie Underwood were singing those songs, would she have the same success? I don't think so. She might have some success. They're good songs and they're commercial songs, but there's a story there. And that, look, this is true of all. This is the story of 15 Minutes of Fame, right?
Right.
There's a story associated with it. But in music, it's particularly powerful, and the confluence of the two can be really fantastic sometimes.
The moment that just
yep,
happens.
That's
for
it,
that,
the moment. Yep.
For that happens for that person. And so that song, you know, that song permeated American culture for for a while, for months. How many people have recorded Save the Best for Last?
About, I'd have to look it up, somewhere between 12 and 15. And there are some really great records of it, some really great in the sense of interpretation. I mean, there's one by the great jazz pianist Ethel Ennis that's in a minor key.
Now we're standing face to face. Isn't this world a crazy place?
We're talking with Phil Galdston, and he's a songwriter and also a comedy writer. Has written comedy songs for comedians, and Robert Klein, for instance, who always has a song in his thing. And how did you come to work with Robert Klein and get involved in comedy?
Well, first of all, I want to make clear that I'm much more a comedy coordinator and consultant than I am a writer, although I appreciate your acknowledging my contributions to comedic songs. Much appreciated. I'm not sure anybody's ever said that before. Thanks. I met Robert, well, I certainly knew his work, and I met him when our mutual managers asked me if I would be willing to play piano in a short piece he did in his set at the time, a musical piece, because Robert's quite a fine musician and wonderful singer as well. And he's quite an educated musical maven, everything from doo-wop to Bach to theater. He's, you know, Tony nominated musical theater performer, very talented. And at that time, Robert, who's a veteran of Second City, did a segment in his show in which he sang a song that he sang at that time two songs he had written, and so he needed somebody to play piano, and then he would undertake the Second City adventure called Make a Song, where the performer takes title suggestions from the audience and proceeds to make up a song on the spot. And for a rather, brainy, let's put it, and I don't mean that in the sense of being intelligent, I just mean kind of overthinking songwriter at the time, this was a fantastic education because I had to think on my feet. And that's what led me eventually to realize that songwriting, of course, is really just improvisation codified. You jam something, you say, oh, I like that, let me keep that. And then you jam something else, you say, I like that, let me keep that. And eventually you wind up with something that's in a structure that you're happy with. So that's how I met Robert. First, the first work I did with him was 2 weeks at the Bitter End. My band, Freeway, was opening for him. And every night I'd get to go on stage with him. Every show I'd get to go on stage with him for about 15 minutes, fooling around at the piano. And when I graduated from college a couple of years after that, he invited me to start touring with him. And that was when he was making his first album, Child of the 50s, so I got to co-produce the songs on it. And then once we were on the road promoting that record, I became the expert on his material. And I began to take notes. And my taking notes on his shows meant that he didn't have to perform for an hour and a half every night and then go back to a hotel room and listen to the tape for an hour and a half night just to find a few morsels he'd done differently. Because I could tell him what he'd done differently. And through that, he very kindly invited me to co-produce his albums with him. So I became a comedy producer. And then, of course, since we continued to make a song, we began to do more musical work together.
And I remember his albums back in the days when he made albums always had a, you know, well-produced song on them.
Yeah, well, thank you. Those were mine. Thanks. Yeah, he's continued to do that. And all of his HBO specials have wonderful musical sections in them. Sometimes full productions. He's got a wonderful musical director who's been with him for many years, Bob Stein. And he's had some really, really talented people work with him over the years, and I mean way beyond me, Rob Hyman of the Hooters. Used to do it when I couldn't do it in Philly. Rob Hyman would do it, and many other wonderful people have worked with Robert. He's got good musical taste.
Freight train, I mind my P's and Q's. I've never been in prison. Have I the right to sing the blues? I got the middle class educated, college boy graduated. I work 9 to 5. Watch the Walter Cronkite News. I love Walter. I never beat my woman, no matter what she may say. I'm even sound authentic, baby, but I don't even talk this way. I got the middle class educated. Folks want me to be a doctor.
Phil Galston, I want to thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf, and I hope you'll come back and continue this conversation soon.
Anytime, Gary. I've had a great, great, great experience. Thank you.
Well, that's it for this week's Songbook edition of From the Bookshelf, and I hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll join us again next week for another great show. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on Facebook and iTunes. I want to thank Phil Galston for being my guest this week, and thanks, as always, to our From the Bookshelf staff, the lovely Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.